under the general title of A View from the Water's Edge, and subtitle is Change, and then there are several subtitles. But going on with our whole business of changing communities, today, taking courage from Herb Brokering, this is a festival of color. I don't know what's going to happen, but the Lord has been doing some neat things and bringing some people together who are going to help us make the festival. We have a course at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary called People of Color, which every student is required to take. Began last year, and it was one of the things that some of us who were on the board were concerned about having initiated. So we have the course, and it is also taught off location in various parts of the church. And the faculty are Sam Hernandez and Ed Yee, Ramona Rank, who is a Native American from up in the Northwest here somewhere, Tacoma or Seattle, and Will Hertzfeld, who is a black man. It was interesting to me when Sam Hernandez told about the faculty, he mentioned the names, and then he said, we have a German named Will Hertzfeld. So the course is People of Color, which in a way is kind of a misnomer because we are all people of color. We're more or less really brown, if you come right down to it. And I was talking to Sam Hernandez one day, and I said, you know, if you mix all colors together, you get a brown. So that it's possible that Adam and Eve were brown people. And highly likely, because from brown you get all the other variations. And he said, well, maybe God was brown then. And I said, yes, I guess she was. So anyway, we have that kind of thing going, trying to get all of the diversities of creation into our thinking about people and about God. Very important, you know, if we all came from God and we were created in God's image, then all of the diversities of creation must be represented in God's nature. And it's kind of good to think that way. So I just wanted to begin then by calling your attention to some of the literature that is available that will help you understand the diversity of God's creation and some new ways of thinking theology. We were talking this morning about the Gospel of John and about the woman at the well. And I had heard, my mother lives with me now, and she had turned on the television early one Sunday morning, and Jimmy Swaggart was on. And I don't know if any of you know who he is, but anyway, he was expounding on the woman of the well. And of course, he painted her in as lurid colors as he could, as a woman of promiscuity and all that. And so we were talking about it, and I said, it always distresses me when I hear that. When, because a woman had five husbands in those days, didn't necessarily mean that she was promiscuous. It simply meant that it was so easy for her husband to divorce her, and it was so difficult for her to get education, and so impossible for her to own property, that all she could do to survive was be married. So if one husband put his hand in hers, you know, and said, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, or I repudiate you, I repudiate you, I repudiate you, she was out if he did that in front of witnesses. And she had no recourse to the law, no opportunity to earn her living, and then the only possibility for survival was find another husband, if you were lucky. And if you finally got too old and too worn out, you know, maybe then a man would just want a housekeeper and you'd go and live with him. So when I hear that, I think how unjust. Yeah. And I also think we also need to get new ways of thinking about ourselves as diverse people of God. I wish there were more people of other than Northern European background here. I happen to be half Polish, but I don't suppose there's any other Polak around here either. But we need to think in other terms about theology. I also regret that our Lutheran theological seminaries are locked into what is European theology. So we consider those primary sources. And if students tell me if they quote other theologians of the Liberation Theology School, often they are graded down because those are considered not primary sources. I think we have to start changing some of that thinking. So in the library here, James Cone, and there are other books of James Cone's here, not too many, Black Theology and Black Power, very good. And here's another one of his, Liberation, A Black Theology of Liberation, very good. And then, Lighten Our Darkness is a good one to read just generally. But A Theology of Liberation, Gustavo Gutierrez, and that is a very definitive work in the whole liberation theology theme. But until we start liberating our own thinking, you know, we're not going to have a liberated church that can encompass all the diversities of God's creation. So I thought, as preface to our Festival of Color this morning, which I don't know what's going to happen, but her brokering assures me that things are going to happen when you have a festival. And I haven't planned the festival, but I know some things are going to happen, so that's exciting. As a prelude to what we're going to be talking about this morning, to kind of free our minds, I'm going to read some poems of Langston Hughes. I think Langston Hughes probably speaks of the soul of the oppressed, speaks from the heart of the oppressed as well as any poet could. Listen to this. And Herb, I assure you this is going to trigger all kinds of responses in you.
You already have.
Well, good. We got a festival going. It's called Merry-Go-Round. And it's about, and he says, a colored child at carnival. Where is the Jim Crow section on this merry-go-round, mister, 'cause I want to ride? Down south where I come from, white and colored can't sit side by side. Down south on the train, there's a Jim Crow car. On the bus, we're put in the back. But there ain't no back to a merry-go-round. Where's the horse for a kid that's black? If that doesn't get to you, nothing will. Frosting. Freedom is just frosting on somebody else's cake, and so must be till we learn how to bake. I picked out some here that I especially wanted to read. Go slow. Go slow, they say, while the bite of the dog is fast. Go slow, I hear, while they tell me, you can't eat here, you can't live here, you can't work here. Don't demonstrate. Wait, while they lock the gate. Am I supposed to be God or an angel with wings and a halo on my head while jobless I starve dead? Am I supposed to forgive and meekly live going slow, 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 slow? Georgia dusk. Sometimes there's a wind in the Georgia dusk that cries and cries and cries in lonely pity through the Georgia dusk, veiling what the darkness hides. Sometimes there's blood in the Georgia dusk left by a streak of sun, a crimson streak, a trickle in the Georgia dusk. Whose blood? Everyone's. Sometimes a wind in the Georgia dusk scatters hate like seed to sprout their bitter barriers where the sunsets bleed. Langston Hughes. The Panther and the Lash. The Panther and the Lash, poems of our times. And then, how many of you are familiar with Kosuke Koyama, Water Buffalo Theology, from Thailand and all those Asian places from which people are coming to our country. And some beautiful imagery. I heard a pastor read it one day and he said, "I don't get it." You know, which just simply shows how locked in we are to our own theological traditions. But I'd like, Sharon, you want to come and read this with me? And you can be the missionary. Now, this is a conversation between a missionary and a woman suffering from cancer. You're the missionary.
"How are you today? I have come to visit you, hoping that I may talk with you a few minutes about the Christian religion.
I feel neither well nor bad. If you want to tell me your dharma, what, you are a teacher of religion, aren't you? Go ahead."
"Yes, I am a teacher of the Christian religion. This book I have in my hands is a scripture. Just as the Tripitaka is very important for Buddhism. This book is very important for us. There is a prayer, quite short and concise, in the scripture. The name of it is the Lord's Prayer."
"Oh, just a minute. I'm a Northern Thai woman. Speak to me in the Northern Thai dialect. You said that you are a teacher of religion, didn't you? How can anyone be a teacher of religion unless he is at home with the language of the people? Speak to me in the dialect. I'm tired of hearing your poor Thai."
"I am sorry. I can speak only the Bangkok Thai."
"I thought so. You cannot. I don't like people like you. You missionaries are always trying to teach people while you really do not understand the people. The Buddhist monks are much better than you missionaries. I will call in a monk right now. I will listen to him. He will understand me. He can comfort me with his dharma because he can speak my own language. You're wasting your time here. Go home." Sorry to dismiss you that way. Thank you for helping me read. Some of the things we were talking about yesterday, when I put up this map about our colorful Los Angeles area, which shows the Hispanic population predominating. Those are the dominant cultural groups in those different areas of Los Angeles. And as I mentioned yesterday, the only difference is that it isn't colorful enough. Still shows too much pink, which is supposed to be us Caucasians or Anglos. And actually much more Hispanic, much more Asian. These yellow, almost solid there, solid here. There are more people living in Gardena, California, of Japanese background than any city in the United States except in Hawaii. And there are as many Native Americans in Los Angeles as in any other city in the country. There are more Koreans in Los Angeles than in any other city in the country. And out of a supposed 20 million, approximately, people who are of Hispanic background, 4.4 million live in California, and 2.2 million of those people who live in Los Angeles. More people of Mexican descent live in Los Angeles than in any other city other than Mexico City. So we have a situation there that is going to call for some indigenization of the church, or we're just not going to be able to speak to the needs of those people. Now you say, well, they're all Catholics, aren't they? Well, we had a dialogue with Bishop Juan Arzube of the East Los Angeles Parish Diocese, and he said there is no way the Catholic Church is equipped to take care of the numbers of Hispanic people in this area. And he said 85% of Hispanics come from Catholic background, but only 15% of that 85% are active in a parish. And he said there are many needs, physical, spiritual, emotional, relational, among the Hispanics. We cannot take care of them all. We don't even have enough priests. And I heard this year from Sister Sandra Schneider, a member of the faculty at the Jesuit School of Theology in Berkeley, that in the country of France, they graduated and ordained one priest last year. So he said, we just aren't equipped. Tucson, Arizona, heavy Mexican population, only within the last decade got its first Spanish-speaking priest. Before that, they imported them all from Ireland. Well, you know, as long as you had a Latin mass, that was transcultural. You didn't have to worry about the language. But it certainly did not encourage rapport with the people. And so masses of Spanish-speaking people left the churches, and really the religion of the Hispanic exists in the home and transmitted often through the grandmother. But to understand this, now, I mentioned to you that the majority of our Lutheran churches in the Southwest are in the Los Angeles area. In East Los Angeles, where there's a population of at least 250,000 Hispanic people out here, at least 250,000 in that area, 20 Catholic parishes, there is one very tiny, little, long-time German Lutheran LCMS church. There are very few Protestant churches out there. This last year, we started, as part of my work, a mission that is a Spanish language mission. It is not starting right away as a Word and Sacrament ministry. It's in a storefront on Whittier Boulevard near Atlantic, if you know Los Angeles. And the pastor is a graduate of Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary, Pastor Frank Aguirre. And Frank is working there. He's feeling his way along. We don't know how to do Lutheran mission among Hispanics in this country. But because this is a festival, and yesterday I prayed, now, Lord, you know how scared I am of festivals, because I don't like to go in there and not know what's happening, but you're going to have to help me. Guess what happened this morning? Guess what happened this morning? At breakfast, we sat down at a table, and across from us was a couple. And we introduced ourselves, and they introduced themselves. And their names are Bill and Marge Rice. And guess what? They have been missionaries in Nicaragua and missionaries in a Spanish language mission in San Pedro, California. Down around here. That's Long Beach down there. San Pedro over here. And I said, the Lord sent you. You're an answer to prayer. And they were going hiking this morning, but he said, I'll be back for your class. So Bill and Marge, come on up here. Or just sit where you are. I think you're going to be heard there anyway. But I am going to read something in my miserable Spanish, and he's going to tell you what the heart of that says. And then maybe he can speak to the heart of the Hispanic person in this country. And many of them, probably for every person in this country legally, there is one here, what we call illegally. I don't like the term illegal alien. We call them undocumented taxpayers. Because for every $2 million they get in social services, and very few of them ever apply for social services, they bring in, it has been estimated by the tax people, $48 million in taxes. Because their employers collect the tax and they get no benefits from it later on. Mexico, mi patria, donde nací mexicano, dame la bendición de tu poderosa mano. Voy a los Estados Unidos para ganarme la vida. Adiós, mi tierra querida, te llevo en mi corazón. No me condenen por dejar así mi tierra. La culpa es de la pobreza y de la necesidad. Does that say anything about the heart, Jose?
This is a cry of a Mexican leaving Mexico asking for a blessing as he goes, because he's leaving to come to the United States to try to make a living. And he says the only reason he's leaving is the poverty that's there.
Tell us about what it is to live among Spanish
people. Marjorie and I attended Multnomah School of the Bible in Portland, Oregon, and during the time we were there, we were challenged by many missionaries who visited the school over the time we were there. And when it came time to leave the school that year, a man came from the Republic of Salvador and challenged us that a whole section of about 85,000 population in eastern Salvador had absolutely no evangelical Christian witness at all. And so we offered ourselves to the Central American Mission for service in Salvador. But being an interdenominational faith mission, they were trying to keep the fields peaceful by segregating the missionaries according to their views on water baptism. We happened to be Baptists by profession, and Salvador was a Presbyterian field, and they thought we might cause a little grief over there, so they said, choose between Honduras and Nicaragua. They're both immersion fields. chose Nicaragua, and were there for 10 years, from 1944 until 1954. We did not fit the category of the little dialogue that the two ladies put on a little while ago of not being able to get close to the people because we couldn't speak their language. We put our best effort into that first, because without the language, you're just almost useless on a mission field. Your contact with the people is so superficial unless you really know the heart of the people. You can't know the people until you speak their language and think their thoughts. So we served there for 10 years, and then I came back to the United States for a couple of years, and then went to Cuba for 2.5 years, and it just happened that we landed in the central part of Cuba in July of 1956, and Fidel Castro came back from Mexico, where he'd been in exile for a couple of years, in November of 56. So the whole time we were in Cuba was a time of revolution. The two countries are very different, and yet the problems are similar in that they're countries where poverty is the big problem. In 56 to 58, the average family income for a Cuban family was $200. And yet we were able to park our station wagon in the street in front of our house because we didn't have a garage for 27 months. We never lost a hubcap or a rearview mirror in the 27 months we were there. It gives you some notion of the type of people the Cubans are, in spite of the tremendous poverty that was there. We came out of Cuba just a few weeks before Castro took the reins of government there, and came back to San Pedro and worked there for about 15 years. We lived in Hawthorne and earned our living working in industry, but giving ourselves voluntarily to the little Spanish missions in the San Pedro area. At that time, there were 15,000 Spanish-speaking people in the South Bay area of Los Angeles. We're right now occupied in a little community church on Locust Island, which happens to be a Spanish surname island, but we have one lady on the whole island who speaks Spanish. We're missionaries to a different kind of people over there just now. I would welcome questions, because I'm sure I'm not reaching the points that...
Well, the Lord sent you to answer questions. Anybody have a question for Bill?
Is there anything being done by this country or other countries to help the poverty in the areas that you're talking about?
It's a very difficult thing because of nationalistic attitude of most of the countries. I can't speak for the rest of the world, but in Latin America, Americans are not free to go in and set up any kind of welfare programs for the people administered by Americans. It must be done through either the government or an agency of that Latin American country. So it's difficult to get the money where it's really needed. Too much of it is lost at the top before it ever filters down to where the people are.
Last June, I had spoke with a Catholic nun who had been in El Salvador and other places in Central America for 18 years, and she spoke of many problems of trying to help the people where the government didn't want them to help them. Did you run into this at that time?
But I would question that the government wouldn't want the people helped. One of the things that the governments of those countries resent a great deal is Americans who come down with all the answers the day they land at the airport. And I can understand why they would resent that. During the early years when we were in Nicaragua, our family doctor was a German fellow, a doctor by the name of Bergheim, who had gone down to Central America with the United States Marines in the early 1900s as a medical doctor. And during the time of the Marine occupation, he had occasion to treat the daughter of the president, who happened to get shot in one of the forays down there, and finally married her. And he had lived down there for about 40 years when we knew him. And that was one of the things that he resented a great deal, that Americans came down, stayed in the Grand Hotel for 3 weeks, came back to the States and wrote a book on Latin American culture and problems. He said, I've been married to one for 40 years and I still am in the process of learning. So it's difficult for people who haven't had the years of contact with the people to know how to solve the problems, and the governments do resent that. And especially if we, as outsiders, get involved in the political solution, because the way we think about democracy and the way they think about it is completely different. During the years that we were in Central America, the political party in the United States changed several times, and the people never could understand how a president of the United States could lose an election. It doesn't happen down there. And why, if he did lose the election, why he would walk away and leave it. After all, he has the control of the arms and the military. There's no reason to give up a plum like that.
Maybe our presidents just haven't gotten that message. Well, yes.
I have a question to link between something you said now about the mission.
A very interesting thing happened to us when we first moved out. We were in the capital for a couple of years studying language when we first went down. Then we went out 50 miles out to a small town of about 4,000. That was our field for 8 years. And it was a big shock to us that the country people called us Lutherans. Being Baptist, it really was the first time that it happened. But to them, anyone who was a Protestant, a non-Catholic, was a Lutheran. I really don't have much knowledge of what the Lutheran Church has done. There was no Lutheran work in the countries where we were that we were aware of. So I don't know what the Lutheran Church has done, but my personal opinion is that you have to get down there and learn the language and spend time with the people in order to minister to them. I have very little faith in big campaigns that come in with a name brand speaker and hold a tremendous rally and an evangelistic campaign in a capital city. We went through several of those in the years we were there, and I saw very little permanent results that came from that. It takes a bridge of personal friendship and of personal dealings with the people over a long period of time before they really come to trust you, especially to trust you enough to give up what they've believed for 10 generations and accept something brand new.
That's very good. I would like to mention there a word that we're learning as kind of key to what we're doing, whether it's in Asian or Hispanic, whatever community where there is a difference, a quite different culture and language. And that a key word is what does the word incarnation mean?
To become flesh.
Yeah, to become part of the flesh of that community and to live among the people. I learned that from Dr. Joe Wong, who is our Asian minister, for a long time the only Chinese pastor ordained in the American Lutheran Church in this country. Started out with the Missouri Synod, served a German congregation in Oklahoma for 7 years, and then another German congregation in Wisconsin. And then there was no other place for them to put him, or the Missouri Synod didn't have place for him, so he came to the ALC, and he became the minister to Chinatown, the Lutheran minister to Chinatown, L.A. And he served there for, has been there for 9 years. And people kept saying, well, do you have a church yet? Do you have a Bible class yet? Have you confirmed anybody yet? But what Joe did is live among the people in Chinatown. And he walked the streets, and he sat down, and he had tea with them, and he went to the city council meetings, and he got in with the juvenile authorities, and he helped them start juvenile programs. Where Joe Wong goes now, everybody in Chinatown affirms. And now, last year, we started a Chinese ministry of word and sacrament with a Pastor Peng, who is who doesn't speak any English but speaks Chinese. And Pastor Peng has gathered together the fruits of Joe's labor, and 150 people come on Sunday mornings. They've outgrown their space. And Joe, because of his intimate knowledge of the needs of that community, has gotten from the government last year $11.5 million for a home for aged Chinese people. Now, that's incarnational style. Joe lived among the people. And he was one of them, and he identified with their needs. He didn't come out in like with the last word.
In 1977, we were fortunate to be able to return to Central America after about 26 years of being back in this country. And we visited this small town where we had lived for 8 years and found the people that we had known during the years that we were there. And it was interesting to us to notice that not a single case for the families that we visited who had been good friends of ours remembered anything that we had said to them, but they remembered everything we had done for them.
And you see, that's theologically sound. That's the way to do it. Jesus did it that way. Left the glory of the Father, came and identified, took upon himself the form, human form, and lived among us. Comparable, as C.S. Lewis says, to us deciding we want to go down to help the ants live a better life and being willing to take upon ourselves the form of an ant and live in an anthill and maybe have somebody squash us on a sidewalk. Comparable to that. That's what incarnation means, living with the people where they are. Do you have a song you can teach us? Wondered if you and Margie have a song you can teach us in Spanish. Some... Is there a simple chorus? I know in Los Angeles the people like to sing De Colores, but do you have one that comes to mind quickly? While you're thinking about that...
Let's think on that a second.
All right. Then I'm going to... Herb Brokering came out to the Pacific Southwest one time, and we talked a lot and we walked around and we set up places for Herb to go and walk in the communities, especially Spanish language communities. And maybe some thoughts have been coming to the surface as you sat here out of that experience, Herb.
Yes, I'd like to talk about what Bill just said, because I think it's I think I stumbled into it. I don't remember anything I said, and I don't remember really anything that anyone said to me in your town, but I remember where we went. We went on a hill, and we saw where the, in the valley they call them Mexican Americans, I guess the Hispanic people live, and we saw the line move, and we got stuck up on the hill, and we took old mattresses and got ourselves out. This was the leader of your work, Hernandez, and I did that. We spent a half day in a truck. I remember that. I've never spent a half day in a truck in a city with a church official in my life, getting stuck and using mattresses to get out. It was ingenious. And I saw walls where they had come to paint the walls because they wanted to feel at home. So they painted the walls to make it like a souvenir. And then I saw walls where someone sort of a specialist in wall painting came, and he painted, or she, or they painted the walls. And then in between and through all these professional paintings, you see the wall, the ordinary people painting the walls, and that's called, I guess that's called scribbling over. Or I don't know what you call it. I don't remember that anyone ever told me what it was called, but it's that they wanted to know that this was home.
I'll tell you what they're doing about it in Los Angeles. One of the county commissioners is trying to get a ban on the sale of spray paint.
Is that right?
So
well,
people can't spray.
There'll be something else.
Their messages
then, I suppose,
on the wall.
It's just, you know, it was just in there a little while. And just one more thing. Dr. Roland Bainton, who really has gotten into many cultures in his 88 years of life, wanted to go, and we didn't get there. But he wanted to have a Reformation festival in Los Angeles. And I said, well, where would you go? He said, let's do it in a barrio. We didn't get there. But if you could do that, Marge, I think we could come next year. He would like to go into a barrio. And I said, well, what would you do there? He said, I would look, and I would listen. He says, that's where you always start in a manuscript. So this Yale scholar wants to go to a barrio. He'll be 89 then. So he'll be okay. I think he can make it. So try and get us into a barrio, Reformation, 1983. It would be an amazing thing to think of Bainton, who could spend it in a Norwegian or in a Lutheran, a German congregation, would choose to go to a barrio.
You know that barrio in Spanish is simply the word for neighborhood.
Yeah.
And in East Los Angeles, they have great fiestas. Cinco de Mayo is the big...
He said it wouldn't have to be Reformation weekend. It could be when the barrio is really going.
Yeah.
So then, in other words, when there's Reformation going on there. And he'd like to know what Reformation means in Los Angeles. I think he'll come.
We'll have a festival out there.
Sure.
But you can imagine with the tremendous growth of the Hispanic population that you saw on the map, that the theme I chose this morning represents much of Anglo thinking. Amigo, go home. You know, go. Leave us. And the sense of being overwhelmed. And the force of the Spanish language wherever you go. And to try to arrive at some understandings of the pain that was reflected in the poem I read, or the little song, about the only thing that brings us here. You know, the 12 million people in Mexico City don't care to come here. They have no need. It's the people who can't find the jobs, who are poor in the country often, and then they come enticed by American multinational corporations to Tijuana, right on the border, south of the border. Enticed by those corporations for low-paying jobs, 75% of which are for women. They're the garment workers. And so the men come with them, there's nothing for them to do. They're jobless. And the women don't make enough to support the family in these low-paying jobs. So they cross the border to try to find work. And we have enticed them that far, and then we put up a fence that has rolls of barbed wire on the top like the Berlin Wall, but they find ways of getting over it, under it, around it, through it. And then we have beyond the fence is a big flattened out area where no shrub grows, so they have to run across bare land, and the border patrol gets them. How does the church react? We go on the basis in our ministry that the green card, which is the document that says you can be in this country, the green card is a problem of the United States government. It's not the church's problem. We are concerned about human needs. So where we do ministries, we have a ministry close to the border, Lutheran Church of the Reconciliation, and that ministers to all kinds of needs of people who come across the border. We don't ask questions. If we did, we would not have any trust. We simply, if people are hungry, if babies are sick, if people need care, we provide the care and do it in the name of Christ. And so they're ministered to wholly. There are a lot of myths and a lot of lies growing up around the status of the undocumented workers in that part of the country. the myth that they're taking jobs away from our own citizens. The jobs they take, none of our citizens want. They're the jobs that all minorities have taken when they've come to this country. When the Jews came over, they took these low-paying service jobs. We know when the blacks came to this country, we know what kinds of remuneration they got. It's a slave labor force that exists. When people from any part of the country come over, Asians, Mexicans, Cubans, they start with these low-paying jobs until they get language skills and the technological skills to apply for other jobs. Nobody wants those entry-level jobs, so that's a myth. And yet, the affluent society of Orange County and the affluent society of Los Angeles area and San Diego cannot maintain its standard of living without those that slave labor force. So many of the illegals who are brought into this country are brought in by corporations. They're brought in trucks, hidden under produce or whatever else, to serve as a slave labor force in factories, garment factories, whatever. And often what has been uncovered, and this a grant was given to a group to uncover some of the abuses that were taking place with human lives in this slave labor force, where they discovered people living without sanitary facilities, without fresh water, people drinking out of irrigation ditches that were full of pesticides and pollution because they had no fresh water available. And I lived for a weekend in Florida with a farm worker family at South Dade Camp. And that's a fairly good place where they have permanent houses. And some of the tragedies there, for instance, the family I lived with, Lupe and Maria, and they have 13 children. And he became a crew boss in the tomato fields. And he saved and saved and saved until he got enough money. Crew bosses make a little more money. And until he could buy a truck to haul tomatoes. And then he could also get some money for hauling tomatoes. And the year he got the truck, they changed the kind of carrier they used for tomatoes, and they used these kind that look like the gravel bins, you know, that they come out the bottom. So his truck stood there. And they do not get paid for days it rains or when it doesn't work. And I was there at the time that the plane spraying pesticides flew over while people were working in the fields. And they're not supposed to do that. But they may spray in this field, but over this field are people working and the wind is blowing this way. So children are very ill often with mysterious ailments. And yet some of these abuses are being uncovered. And there's been a big push in the Los Angeles area to uncover abuses in the garment worker industry downtown. And some of the labels on the dresses produced at these by people who get maybe 75 cents or a dollar to sew a dress are in some of the most expensive stores and sell for $250, $350, $500 in the stores. So those kinds of things are the sort of burden that we must bear as people who benefit from a society just by being born white. The unearned benefits of being born white is something that we all have to deal with. But the church is trying to minister to needs. And now let's sing a song, if you have one.
Yo tengo gozo.
Okay.
Yo tengo gozo, gozo en mi corazón, yo tengo gozo, gozo en mi corazón, porque Cristo me salvó.
All right. Tell us what it means.
I have joy in my heart because Christ saved me.
Okay.
Try it with us. Yo tengo gozo, gozo en mi corazón, yo tengo gozo, en mi corazón, porque Cristo me salvó.
Amen. you. Other questions?
I have two questions. One of them is, it seems it has been emphasized for a long time what we, meaning Christians or Lutherans or whatever, are able to do for them. And I think the emphasis is changing, that it's two ways. And I'd like to ask one question. What gifts do Spanish-American people, what gifts should we be sensitive to receiving from them?
Thank you for that emphasis. Yes.
We watch the great flow of immigrants from Cuba within a couple of years after the Castro government was established. And there were literally thousands of them came in the United States, and a lot of them were moved to Los Angeles because Florida was so filled up they just couldn't handle anymore. And they were offered transportation to California, rental for 1 month, and $100 for groceries. And many thousands of them came to Los Angeles area. And we knew a lot of them because they came into the South Bay area too. And so far as I know, none of them ever went on welfare. Those people went to work right away. There's one couple that I think of especially, both the man and the woman, they brought three children with them. Both the man and the woman were registered nurses in Cuba, but they were not allowed to bring any documents out of Cuba to show what their training was. They were just stripped bare when they came out of Cuba. Just the clothes they had on was all they could bring. So they were not able to find any employment as nurses in the United States. And I hired the man and his son to paint our house, and I've never seen a fellow work harder in my life. And through contacts that we had with him, we were able to get him a job for a Harvey Aluminum in a punch press shop there. And within 30 days, that fellow was lead man in the shop as an immigrant Cuban. They have a lot to contribute. I think I would have to agree in large measure with what Mrs. Wolf said, that they do take the jobs that are at the bottom of the heap. It used to irritate us a great deal, the fact that people born in the United States who've been here all their lives, who have no language problems, are unemployed in Los Angeles by tens of thousands, while immigrant Cubans who have no language skills can find employment. I think they have a lot to contribute to this country. We knew another man who was the assistant chief of police in Havana for the first 2 years that the Castro regime was in power. When he discovered that he had cooperated in a Cuban revolution, which was really a communist thing, he came out of the country and went back with the Bay of Pigs thing and was captured there. He spent 14 months in the Isle of Pines prison. And when he got back, he said, "Now I know what I'm worth." The United States government gave $64,000 in tractors and medicine to bail me out. That's my value as a human being. When we knew him, he was an orderly in Harbor General Hospital, carrying bedpans and that sort of thing. A man with a high degree of education and yet willing to take anything to support his family.
Thank you.
Yes, I have a tiny story that says something in answer to the question of what can we receive. I was in a Spanish-speaking congregation down there in the valley in South Texas. And I said, "Play me your church music." So she played Bach. And I said, "Do you like Bach?" "Oh," she said, "I like Bach very much." And she really does. It took 2 hours for her to agree that she liked mariachi music and that her fingers were fine. And she could imagine. But she looked around like as though she were going to whisper it, lest anyone there hear her, that she would like once to hear mariachi play A Mighty Fortress. Would you believe? Something like that, with the horns and everything, in the idiom of the Mexican people. She was excited about that. And then that evening we had a festival. Nine came. And we had one musical instrument. It was the gourd, maracas. It had never been played in this congregation. The congregation is 40 years old. There had never been a maracas in it. The only reason they did it is that this dummy came from afar, and said, "Would someone bring a maracas?" I didn't know what to call it. I said a gourd that rattles. So they brought it. And that's the only instrument we had. I can still remember how we went through the seven last words on the cross. And when he gave up his spirit, and you had this rhythm, and these different rhythms, and these different exciting rhythms, and all of a sudden, no rhythm. And we for the first time, you know, the maracas got in. Oh, I mean, I was excited. I don't know. I don't have very many places to go to talk about it because other people are in power places in the church to make some decisions. I don't know how you get maracas into the church or anything like that, or mariachi. But I did have a chance just a few weeks ago because 5,000 women came to the convention and they asked me to do a festival in the arena in San Antonio, and I did. And the Germans down there said, be sure the Germans are in it. So I got a German band. And then someone said, be sure that the Norwegians are in it. So I got a Norwegian quartet. But the Spanish people in the valley said, do you remember when you came, we played the maracas? We're ready, and they got in a bus. And I said, you get a spot in the arena and a mic in the middle. And that's all anyone got. And when we sang Beautiful Savior in German, and then we sang Beautiful Savior in Norwegian, and then they sang Beautiful Savior, oh my. And then I just say, oh my, because it means dot, dot, dot. You can just imagine. I mean, I can't tell you what the festival was like. But I think now the 5,000 people heard something that also keeps the story alive and also helps shape the rhythm and the rhyme and the mood of the gospel. And it's near us. See, but it's starting. It's starting in all kinds of ways and places. Just one more tiny story. And then there was a nun. I heard that she could tell stories, so I phoned her because I was looking for a resource. She said her name was Sister Sally. And I said, do you know what happened in 1531? She said, do I ever? See, I thought maybe she'd think that the Augsburg Confession was 1 year old. But she didn't think about that. She was in Mexico and I was in Europe. So she came to the arena. And we gave her a minute and 20 seconds. And she told about this one king who was king over, as it were, Mexico and king over Germany at the same time. And this time of Luther, this version of Guadalupe's story emerged. And for the first time, a lot of Lutheran people heard the story of the Virgin of Guadalupe right alongside. And then she said, and Martin was living, very busy at that time. She only gave Martin 10 seconds. But we knew the Martin story, we just didn't know it was at the same time. We had a festival because we saw two whole nations busy under Charles at the same time, trying to struggle with their faith. And God came through a man named Martin. God also, really, I guess, came through an Indian boy.
Yeah.
So there are
festivals. We our time is just about up, but we have had a festival. And that doesn't mean, when I talk about the church among the people, incarnation doesn't mean losing your identity at all. It means walking among the people, assuming theirs, but knowing who you are. And we do not describe that everybody has to play Bach. I hope we're beyond that. We are thinking about the indigenization of worship. I facilitated a conference on that, and now conferences we know accomplish so much. So, without a doubt, we are going to now, from now on, have indigenization of worship, a la Article 7 of the Augsburg Confession, and that ought to make it good. But let me just tell you one thing we did in Grand Forks, North Dakota when we were there. We saw every May the migrants came to the Red River Valley of the North. And so some of us thought, why don't we welcome them? So we had Norwegian-Mexican Festival. And we had a parade and floats down the main street with national costumes, Norwegian-Mexican, an awful lot alike. And then we had bake-offs between the Norwegian ladies and the Mexican ladies. And we found that tortillas and lefse are an awful lot alike. So we found real intercultural exchange without anybody losing anything, but everybody gaining a great deal. So hasta la vista. Bendiga.